You can review what you want to review. When you have a podcast, it's to review a new podcast. And for my next filmmaker we're going to be looking at a legendary name in comedy, especially sketch comedy. Someone whose show In Living Color I personally grew up on. It was the coolest sketch show on TV. SNL can eat a dick. And that man is the ringleader of the Wayans family, Mr. Keenan Ivory Wayans. Going to be looking at his movies. And this week, I'm going to be looking at his breakout blaxploitation satire, I'm Gonna Get You Sucker, with this week's special guest, Ken from Dead End Hip Hop. Ken, let the lovely people hear your voice.
Lovely people, you can hear my voice. What's going on, man?
Let the people know, you know, what you're representing, what you're doing over there, so they can, you know what I mean? If they like your commentary, they can go check you out.
Yeah,
you know?
appreciate it. Yeah, man, we do a little thing on YouTube. It's a hip hop review and commentary show where we just talk about the culture of hip hop in general. And that's part of what we do. We've been doing that since 2011. It's called Dead End Hip Hop. And then we created a podcast network, which has our premiere show, the big one. Is the Mic Still On? So you guys can check that out. Mm-hmm. And then just a bunch of other shows, man, that's also on the network as well. Dead End Gaming, Frames Per Second, which is our movie review and TV recap show, and Dead End Sports, and you know, we're doing some reviews on the Dead End Hip Hop podcast feed as well. So, and a lot of other shows also. So, yeah, if they like what they hear or just curious, they can go check those out there on the internet.
My family used to watch In Living Color. Like, I remember watching that show ever since I was in diapers, you know. So, but what's your relation to the Wayans family?
Oh, man, pretty much the same thing, man. Just growing up watching them on, you know, In Living Color. I mean, it was hilarious, man. It was just dope to see, like, black guys on TV, black people on TV making that type of content, doing that type of comedy, man. So it was rare for me to see something like that.
And like I said, I really do believe, like, they were picking up the slack when it came to sketch comedy when, like, SNL was going through the worst of the worst, from what I remember. Like, that was the period where it was like, nah, no one really gives a crap about SNL at that point, you know? And then I feel like Mad TV kind of picked it up for a while, but Mad TV literally only existed because of the cancellation of In Living Color. You know about that?
I used to watch Mad TV. I used to actually, I read the magazines too. My dad, he would get them all the time, so that's how I would read them. So yeah, I know about Matt.
Yeah, the funny thing about it is, so In Living Color was a thing on Fox first, right? Then it was like in the last season, the Wayans family pulled out and they replaced them with like a whole bunch of like white actors or something like that, and the show just didn't do really well in its last season. And not all white actors, but like just more white actors in the role. I remember that. And then it was like it went off the air, and there was some sort of dispute with the family, and you know, the censorship and that sort of thing. Then House of Buggin came on, which was John Leguizamo's show. So it was kind of like highlighting, you know, Hispanic Americans and like that sort of skit comedy. Mm. You know what I mean? And that was on for like 1 year in like 1994. And then there was something about how, like, the network was like, oh, well, you need to have, you know, a couple more white people on your show. And I think it was like David Herman was the only white guy on House of Buggin. And, you know, John Leguizamo apparently wouldn't budge on that. So they canceled that show. And then in 1995, you get Mad TV with the mostly white hosts and a couple of black people sprinkled out. You know, so it's kind of like, oh, wow, the executive people got what they wanted, you know. But at what cost, man? But no, I'm like, I still rock with Mad TV for such a long time. But I think it's just so funny. There's that direct through line there of like these two shows that I really enjoyed. You know what I mean?
Yeah, and I didn't know any of that history. So I just got a history lesson there. So that is real interesting just to hear that, man.
That's crazy, yeah, man. Right? Well, looking up about Keenan Ivory Wayans, I found out he was a writer on Hollywood Shuffle and Eddie Murphy's Raw. Like the comedy special.
I didn't know that.
I'm Gonna Get You Sucker was like the proto In Living Color for him in a way, right? Because it was like if you watch the movie, it does kind of feel like things are sort of, you know, not made for a plot, but for the idea of, oh, wouldn't this be a funny skit? Wouldn't this be a funny skit? You know?
Yeah, it was a lot about like the joke, and it felt like at times they were riding towards to the punchline that they had. And, yes. So that's what I got at
riding really hard on the punchline. Yeah, yeah. Leading up to the punchline. Mm-hmm. Starting off, we get the beginning of the movie. Let's get right into it. Where so Junebug, who is the familiar relationship in this movie, is a little confusing. maybe you can help me figure it out. Okay, so Junebug has recently died of OGing, which is dying of overdosing on too many gold chains. So over-golding, which I think is a really funny way to, like, you know, just send up the revenge fantasy setup that is in all these blaxploitation films. You know, it's always they OD'd on crack or something like that that was going on. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Or no, I guess it was the 70s, so it was like heroin, you know. So you have Junebug, this character who you find out dies of OGing. And of course, there's this running gag of like, how does he go to the bathroom with all this shit on? There's John Witherspoon in a great little cameo there. Rest in peace. But then you kind of get to the idea of like, oh, you know, Junebug didn't have anyone in his life. And the only people that cared for him was this young woman and this older woman who is Keenan Ivory Wayans' main character's real mom, right?
Mm-hmm.
And his brother was Junebug, but the girl that's with the older brother was dating Junebug and Keenan Ivory Wayans.
She was married. Wait, I thought she was married. Was she married to him?
I don't know. Because it was like, at first it was like, oh, that's the reason why she's over there, because she's like married to this guy. But then later on in the plot, it's like, I wanted to be with him because he reminded me of you. And it's like, wait, what's happening?
Yeah, I didn't. Okay, so I was 12 when this movie came out. So I was 1988. So I wasn't really like connecting all of those dots like that back then. But, you know, thinking about it now as an adult, that is creepy. Like when you think about when he first walked in, you know, he missed the funeral. You already have Damon and Kadeem Harrison going in, making their...
And they are hilarious, yeah. By the way. I think they're like the lifeblood of the comedy of the movie.
Yeah, Willie and I forgot the other guy, Damon's character's name. Maybe I think it was Lenny. But anyway, so yeah, so they go in and, you know, try to beat up the mom and all this other stuff, and you know, do the whole little running bit about there's two ways to leave. You can take the windows or the stairs, and, you know, throw them down the stairs, and then here you go with you know, Jack Spade, and he shows up. Yeah,
that's his name. Yeah,
and then
yeah.
But he's looking at his dead brother's girl or wife. And it's like supposed to be this big romantic moment. And I'm like, that's kind of weird because your brother just died.
Yeah, I was like, wait. And it's like, they didn't play it up comedically. So it was just kind of like, is this just supposed to be okay? Are we not supposed to think about that?
Yeah, because, you know, of course there's supposed to be a love interest, but I didn't think the love interest was supposed to be your dead brother's girl. But
yeah, like at first I thought like they were brother and sister, because it was confusing, because I was like, wait, there's the mom in the house and she's around, so is she the daughter?
Yeah.
Right? Like, but no, she's not the daughter, but yeah.
Yeah, that was weird.
I wanted to specifically bring up what I feel is like the backbone of what the sort of narrative in a way of the movie, right? There's so the very initial beatdown that happens is not because of Jack Spade, it's because of the mom that beats up the two goons and, you know, sends them down the stairs, and then, you know, Jack Spade doesn't even know what's going on. And so when they complain to, you know, the man, the white guy, that like, oh yeah, you know, we were trying to get the money, but, you know, the soldier dude came in, you know, the fucking dude. And so, like, they make it seem like it's him that's causing the problem when it was really the mother that was doing it. And, like, as the movie goes on, there's this element of, like, Jack Spade wants to fight, but then his mom keeps coming in and, like, emasculating him, basically, and doing it for him. And I thought that was kind of, like, a funny sort of element that was seeded into the jokey narrative of the movie that sort of undermines this, you know, the 70s, you know, big dicked black dude getting revenge sort of thing that was going on in the 70s. You know, it kind of like undermines it initially just by nature of it being, oh, this guy needs his mom to kick ass for him. You know what I mean? And it happens in like every scene up until the last scene where he tricks mm-hmm. her into going into that one room. You know, so I thought that was kind of a funny, like, oh, okay, they're trying to say something here, but in a fun way. I see you, you know?
Yeah, and I think, you know, if you... like also just think a little deeply about it, because I don't know if they were trying to really, you know, convey a message there outside of just kind of making fun of like the big, you know, black masculine guy needing his mom to you know, come get him out of situation, because, you know, he was cowardly in the beginning or throughout the film. He had very little experience, and they kind of made fun of that, you know, as it went on. But, you know, you think about just growing up in certain areas as well, you know, as kids, and you get into your fight, or at least I had a brother, you get into a fight and you're fighting your brother, and they'll be like, I'm gonna go tell mama, I'm gonna go get my mom. And then you also think about how, you know, the black woman is like, and black women and black moms are like the foundation of households at times. Like, they're the strength and, you know, the protector that goes over thing. And then you think about the kid that's supposed to eventually grow up to become the protector of the household, as he kind of works his way through life and becomes a man and fills himself out. And then all of a sudden, now I'm the man of the house, and now I'm gonna take care of you, mom. I no longer need you to protect me. So, and you kind of see that as, you know, the movie gets toward the end, where, you know, he's like, all right, I figured this out, so this is what I'm gonna do. I got this.
Like, yeah, that great scene where it's like, you think it's gonna be one of the, you know, black exploitation black dudes to come in and save the day, and it's his mom, and he's like, oh, god damn it, mom! That's a great moment. Yeah, even though there are a lot of comedic moments that are kind of like, all right, we already get where the joke is going here. You know, there are still legitimate moments that, like, throw me off. Like, the scene with something in the Tales from the Hood. You know, the Welcome to Hell, the Clarence Thomas III. Yeah, what's his name?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I know you're talking about the revolution, the black
revolution. The bean pie revolutionary dude. Such a great scene. Just the whole thing of, like, where he's like, you know, he says, like, the brothers were going to revolt, you know, they went down to the government building on 34th Avenue and like they were going to take it over, but they were hiring that day. It's like, hey, ain't that what it's all about? You know, Whitey is something else. And then, of course, you know, you have the irony of, like, oh, this guy's talking all this, you know, white people are evil shit. And then, of course, he has this lily white wife with these two kids that he still keeps them quite informed as to, you know, the history of America with the little Abraham Lincoln project that his son has to do. That was, oh my God, just, I'm sure that was just even more, like, uproariously hilarious, just in the 80s having a movie in which a 10-year-old white guy, white boy talks about how, like, you know, Abraham Lincoln, this imperialist colonialist swine. It's like, oh my God. And then, yeah, as I was watching the movie, I was noticing they actually are direct representations of black masculinity in these movies. You know, you got the Isaac Hayes, the smooth type, and then you've got the slammer who's like, you know, just the hardcore, you know, beat you up type of guy. You know, Jim Brown. The Dolomite. Not the Dolomite character. The sweet badass, sweet ass song. You know, that type of, you know, silent badass character. Then you've got the the fly guy character. Fly guy represent the, you know, the stylistic sort of side of things. You know, he's a pimp and you know, he's real smooth for the 70s, which is a hilarious scene when he gets out of jail. And you can tell it's all like ADR, like afterwards recorded stuff. But something about the aesthetic of how they're talking shit about him just works perfectly when the pimp gets out of jail and he's trying to like act like he's still cool. And you just hear, like, you hear it slowly building where people are like, it starts to become obvious how much they don't respect this fucking Big Bird looking pimp guy.
And he thought he was tight too, man. You could tell him shit.
There's one moment where someone says he looked like a clown, and then his fish tank shoe breaks, and it's just so perfectly timed where I just laugh every single time. Just he looks like a clown.
It's
and he's got the fish and the fucking fish tank. Oh, he thought he was so cool.
I used to cry laughing at that scene, man. Like, that's a classic scene in television. Yes,
that's an untouchable
scene. Yeah, that goes down in history. Man. The big bright yellow suit. Hey, man, is it gonna flood outside?
Oh no!
They were tearing him up.
Oh, it's cold blooded. But it really came together for me watching it the second time when the Kung Fu black guy came out.
Kung Fu Joe.
Oh my God. Such a like stereotype of the blaxploitation era, you know, like it's so over the top perfect. Like, especially when he's like, you know, he pulls out the picture of Bruce. He was like, he was my trainer. And he's like, oh my God, he taught you Kung Fu. He's like, no, acting. Just like the fact of like a kung fu guy like existing in, you know, these movies where it's supposed to be set in, you know, America and shit, where it's just like, okay, yeah, with the kung fu Chinese cinema, they would always have the excuse of, you know, no guns are allowed here, no guns are allowed there. But it's like, it's America. And it doesn't matter if you learn kung fu, you go get your ass shot if you.
when the cops pulled him over and.
Oh my God.
I always so laugh dark. when he start talking, and it's in that Chinese style.
Because he's like so, like he so has that like kung fu guy confidence. Ha 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 ha! You cannot face my shouting.
And they lit him up. It was like 57 of you versus me. Yeah, no problem. And they just unloaded.
Oh my God. And then the anti-sex scene of the chick he picks up. You know, he goes over to her. He's trying to, you know, be all swagger. He's like, oh yeah, you know, I got what you need, lady, you know what I'm saying? And he's like, oh, she's like, oh, well, I need 12 inches. And he's like, well, I think I got that for you. And, you know, of course, he reaps what he sows when he gets up with the girl in the back, which I guess there's just an area for them to have sex in the back. I don't know how that worked, but anyway. But, you know, they just needed to do this contrived thing to set up the idea of like, oh, you were lying about having a 12-inch penis? Well, I was lying about everything. And then the point that just had me die was where she takes off her butt and she goes like, ha, it's not even the right color. I was like, oh, no. Because, you know, there's a general idea of like, you know, oh, like, because this woman doesn't look perfect or whatever. You know, there's the shaming of women not looking like, you know, the perfect, beautiful woman, whatever the fuck, coffee brown or whatever the fuck. But the funny thing about that is just how it goes so over the top, like she's missing a leg.
Classic. Just the idea of this woman just taking out all of these parts of who she was supposed to be.
Like, it just keeps getting worse. It's like, oh my God, that's what you get.
Man, the leg, when she took that leg off, she said, don't make me hop after your ass.
Hear the fuck. You know, this is a very wacky, you know, out of control comedy. And I was sort of thinking about Airplane, right, which came before it. And, you know, it's funny, like, Airplane, the parody movie, was making fun of, you know, airport movies, airport dramas, which was apparently a thing in the 70s. And it's like, while it is funny in its own right, like, I don't know what they're talking about. I don't know the tropes that are directly being referenced. But with these blaxploitation tropes, like, I directly knew it because I grew up watching those movies. You know what I'm saying? So in both movies, there's a flashback scene where it's like, oh, flashback to better days when we were dancing. The specific flashback to when we were dancing at some point to 70s music that happens in Airplane and I'm Gonna Get You Sucker. But I like it done in this movie better because it's specifically being done to make fun of those solid gold dancers who were such show-offs. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like, it's specifically ripping on them. So I thought there's like that extra element of joke to it. Like, if you know what this is referencing, it's even more funny.
Yeah,
you know what I mean?
Yeah. That was another one, man, when I was young and, you know, they did that flashback and they just knocking everybody out. And it's just kind of pulling back. You just looking in the background of them dancing and everybody just on the ground, just passed out. Another classic scene for me, man, just watching it. Yeah. Especially at 12, like that sort of slapstick over the top type of comedy was just, it just resonated with me for whatever reason. I don't know. I was just always cracking up at it.
So once the plot, like, kicks in, and, you know, the whole idea is, like, all right, you know, now we've got the team, the assemblage of blaxploitation movie tropes. Now we've got to go take down the man. How are we going to do that? We're going to go take over his clubs. And, you know, these are supposed to be the good guys, mm-hmm. right? And there's just one scene where they just go to a club and just start shooting it up. Like, there's no thematic reason why, like, oh, this makes us the good guys because of how we're doing it. No, like, as far as anyone else in the movie would be concerned, five guys just walked into a club and just started shooting it up. Like, you guys are the bad guys now. Like, what the hell are you doing? And, like, they don't do it in a way where it's like they're hanging a hat on it, you know, to make a joke about the idea of these guys, like, going over the top. It just kind of feels like, no, I feel like just, like, from a writing perspective, they just wanted to show the idea of, look, the good guys are encroaching on the bad guys, but in order to do that, all I could think of was just have them shoot up the club. Because, again, it's just, you guys are just shooting at innocent bystanders, like, what? This isn't even, like, a trope in, like, blaxploitation movies. This is just wrong. The good guys aren't supposed to do this. Why is this happening?
Or it was, and there was another one where they wanted to just set up another joke with the midgets or little people. Yeah.
Oh yeah.
No,
you're right.
And it was so well done because they had been setting that up the whole movie with the I think it's the Evans or whatever. And he, you know, the mama told the story, mm-hmm. and he got, you know, overly emotional about it and wanted to go beat him up. And, you know, he kind of went away. And every once in a while, he'll have this reminder about them and Louis Mitchell. And then all of a sudden, they're sitting in there, and this guy had his big-ass hat on.
You see that? They're aiming the guns, and then, like, they're not paying attention. You see one hat slowly, like, lift up a veil that's on the hat. You see a gun poke out of it. It's just perfectly hilarious. You're like, what is happening in this movie?
And then he just tackles the guy. He was like, man, I was going to go get a scooter pop. Man, look, scooter pop with that.
And did you see who it was, too?
Yeah, I used to see him. You're talking about the black guy, right?
Yeah, the dude from Bad Santa, mm-hmm. and Myself and Irene.
Even thinking about, like, another classic scene, man. Like, if you're around a black person and you say this, Chris Rock scene, when he went in there, and how much for one rib, that is black comedy history. That is a classic. Oh, well, how about you pour it in my arm and let me take a sip?
Okay, was that from something else? Did Chris Rock use that somewhere else? Because I feel like I've seen that him do that routine.
I don't know. I mean, now that you've asked, you're going to make me question it, but, and I would have to look it up.
But this is 1988, so it's like Chris Rock was
exactly
beforehand, but I could swear I remember seeing, like, wasn't he on In Living Color for maybe like a short time and maybe he did it there? Because I'm just like, I know I've heard this skit.
But In Living Color came after this movie.
Yeah, I know. So I'm like, is it just like a retroactive thing where I just heard someone referencing it afterwards? And so I just assumed that, you know what I mean? I don't know. But now, as much as it's a classic skit, I do feel like just in general, Isaac Hayes is just like too slow for the comedic timing of certain moments. You know, like he would be like, yes.
Oh, yeah.
It's like, all right, no. Keep up with it. It's Chris Rock. You know, it's Chris Rock now. He's moving fast.
Yeah, it was really all about Chris Rock. And I think he did a good job of just delivering the joke and being the joke at the same time and overcoming Isaac Hayes' inability to also kind of, like you say, have that timing to go along with it. In his own way
to make
it funnier, to make it be like this annoyed guy. Because I think when he was like, all right, let me get one order of ribs, like, and then he was like, oh, no, I just want one rib. Like, his response didn't really kind of, you know, go in line with the joke itself. Like, there should have been another type of response when he said just one rib.
Yeah, despite the bit of stifled acting with him, he made me laugh so fucking hard when they're loading up the guns, and it's just guns on guns on guns, and the person who's loaded up the most is Isaac Hayes. You see, he's got, you know, two shotguns in both hands. He's got, you know, put the little revolver in the back, you know, like a little 45 in the heel, all this sort of stuff. And he's like, man, you don't think that's too much? He's like, huh, you can never have too much. And then they're just like walking out looking all badass, and he just slips on one piece of like bullet and just goes, whoa! It's so over the top that he just falls and just expends all of his gunfire just immediately after all that buildup. It's just like, despite me knowing that I was going to see it the second time, it still made me laugh so hard just to hear Isaac Hayes just go, and like, you know, after all the badass. And I'm pretty sure they play like fucking war. Good God. You know, so like, you know, the ultimate badass about to fucking fuck shit up song. And then just off time, you just hear this, whoa! And then the cunt just come blasting, and like, wow. Undermines absolutely everything that was happening. Again, another perfectly timed scene. That's the thing about it is, it's the comedy that could be so perfectly timed, you can watch it again and again, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, another part I used to like, I found myself laughing at, was when he was like, yeah, I was in the military or the army. I was trained for this. And then they start shooting at him. He was like, They shooting. Or what about,
I thought you was trained. Oh, no, man. I got this one for kite flying. I got this.
And then there was the one where Sherry. But she had cramps. Remember, she was at the diner. The guy kept bugging her for coffee. And she turned around and she was like this evil creature possessed.
No, that was
but
so
what
good.
Kills it for me every single time was Damon Wayans' scream. Oh, my God. It takes me out. And then Willie come over. He's like, man, yeah, I heard you screaming like a little bitch.
Yeah, I was whistling. You was whistling, help, go get this crazy bitch off me.
Man.
No, I really do feel like when I watch this movie and go back over, I really do feel like Damon Wayans was like the treasure of the group. Because his voice is just funny, his mannerisms are funny, his timing is perfect. I find him to be the star of the show.
Oh, yeah. He definitely stole the show.
Especially at the end where you know, they've been doing you can take the stairs, or you can take and he cuts him off before he can do the joke again. He's like, oh man, I'm tired of shit. Y'all kiss my natural black ass. And he jumps out of the window. And then someone just goes like, anybody tell him about the elevator?
Yeah, and that was good to kind of, you know, like they've been setting it up the whole movie. And then it seemed like they were setting it up again, but they used that to set up another joke. Which was good. Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think they did it like four times, and I remember feeling again when watching the movie again, like, oh, this is gonna get kind of tired. But then, like, in the middle of it happening, like in the middle of the setup for the joke about to happen, Damon Wayans will have a reaction that is so funny that it's just like, okay, but I'm still laughing though. Yeah. You know.
Like, I think the last time when they were shooting on top, when they were on top of the roof, and they told him the same thing. I think that's when I was like, okay, like we've seen this before. And then they kind of like threw themselves down the stairs. But this time what they did was they kind of, instead of showing us them going down the stairs, we heard it. And then we heard them, like, it was a long way down. It wasn't just, like, one flight of stairs. It was multiple flights. So they kind of extended a little bit, but they delivered it in a different way because they probably knew that, you know, the viewing audience would get tired of that joke over and over again. At some point, it wouldn't be funny. So I like that they tried to switch it up.
There's a bit of comedic heightening that happens in small doses that makes it just enough to be worth coming back to. You know what I mean? So in that way, it's like, it, even for something that's like before what I felt like they really were able to do with a movie like Scary Movie and Don't Be a Menace, like you could still see they have the building blocks of making good comedy, you know, just off the rip by being naturally, you know, talented people who know how to make the setups happen. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And then, of course, there's the ending where, you know, there's the callback to, hey, man, we got to have our own theme song. But since it's cool and it's the 80s, we're going to have, you know, BDP, which is actually a pretty fucking cool deep cut to see, especially as like a kid. You know, when I was a kid, like, I'm getting into the old school rappers, you know, so I'm coming up. One of the big guys I listened to was BDP. And I remember I had the best of BDP album, and it had the Jack of Spades song on here. And then one day, like, I'm watching this movie and I was like, this is what it's from. Jack.
Yeah.
Like, I love it.
I thought that was funny. And I think just to kind of show, kind of like you said, like not the parallels, but the difference in, like, you know, he walked out the Shaft, and that was that generation. And then this generation is like hip-hop.
And they actually did have the Shaft music,
So I thought that was dope to just show that where it was, musically at least, and where we are now. Because it's like a drastic turn if you really think about it.
Especially the fact that when you put into context the idea of, like, not even 2 years later, Keenan Ivory Wayans would have his own TV show in which it was maybe, I do believe it's the first television show with a rap song for the theme song. You know, like, that is, like, In Living Color is kind of iconic for hip hop in that, you know, and not only was that, it's like you had fucking Heavy D, you know, who was, like, again, a respected rapper. So it's not like they were just, oh, you know, get MC Hammer or something like that. No, it was like, no, we're actually going to represent the culture. We're having fun, but there is an element of this that is really representing the culture. And so, like, you know, again, watching this movie, yeah, they have these respected actors, you know, or respected people who paved the way for them as filmmakers in the 70s with blaxploitation movies by getting, you know, guys like, you know, Isaac Hayes and them to do the movie. But then at the end of the day, they're still like, oh, but we want to move it to the next generation because we are, like, the younger generation kind of joking on them. So we're going to play it for real by having a respected rapper, BDP, do the theme song. You know, I do like those little, like, the nod that lets you know, it's like, no, we know what's going on. We know what's really going on, but we are going to joke on you. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? And another interesting thing I think that's funny, you've heard the Mad TV theme song, right?
I don't remember it, but I have heard it, yeah.
So Heavy D did In Living Color and Mad TV.
I did not know that. Wow.
That motherfucker was cashing checks in the 90s.
Tell me about it. That's amazing. I can't leave without mentioning one more scene. And when I was a kid, the tears that would be coming down my face was, remember when he got the splinter and he did the Rocky, the Rambo?
Oh, right. Yes. That was a great scene. That was just a great, like, action movie satire scene.
Okay, all right, I'm done. That was it.
This is the problem with talking about comedy. It's just like, I mean, we're just gonna be laughing about the shit that happened.
Anyway, man. Oh, Jesus. Let me get myself together.
We tackled something serious, right? We were talking about the masculinity or something,
yeah.
Right?
That was important. It. Yeah.
Anyways, thank you so much for joining us. See you next time on the podcast. This has been the Review A New Podcast, and with my special guest, Ken, again, you can catch him at Dead End Hip Hop. Look it up on YouTube, Spotify, Dead End Sports, Dead End Gaming, all that fun shit. And until next time, unless there's something else that you wanted to add.
That's it. Yeah, I'm done. Thank you for having me on the show, man. I enjoyed it. Had a good time.
For sure. You know, taking this trip down memory lane and showing respect to the comedic forefathers of this, you know, black internet comedy generation.
Exactly.
Thank you so much. Until next time, this is the Reviewer New Podcast saying, fresh for 2020, you suckers!